from my heart, from my mind, from my strength, I will worship you.
First Samuel. We got halfway through chapter 18 last week, and so we'll pick it up there. We've seen this nation transition from the time of the judges, when God would use men like Samuel, to the time of the kings. Judges didn't have the same kind of authority, the same kind of power. God would work through them, but with a king, you know, a king is just the guy in charge, and sometimes he chooses to let God work in him, sometimes he doesn't, but he's still in charge. Saul was anointed to be the first king, and yet through his continued disobedience to what God was telling him to do, God tells Saul that he's no longer king. Now that it's going to take a few years for that to actually come about. Samuel, in the meantime, sneaks off and finds this young kid and pours oil on his head and declares him to be the king. And this new kid is named David, which means beloved. The word David, the name David, means beloved. Last week we saw God do his first big work in David as he alone faces Goliath, the giant. The first of the big things that God's going to do in David. Now, I got this thing. I didn't notice it till this morning, but I got the email yesterday, and it's from a news source, a friend of ours in Israel. And actually, I checked it out. It's on a bunch of news things. So this is the real deal. There's a fellow named, that's him, Dr. Omar Ja'ara. He's the lecturer at the Al Najah University in Nablus. That means he's Palestinian. His specialty is Israeli affairs. And he said this on Fatah television February 15th. This is what he says. He said that actually Moses led the Muslims out of Egypt. That was his words. Moses led the Muslims out of Egypt, and that the Exodus was actually the first incident of Palestinian liberation through armed struggle. That's what he said. Isn't that amazing? You didn't know that that's what your Bible said. Isn't that amazing? This fellow also claims that it was Saul, not David. He says it was Saul that killed Goliath and got rid of the giants. And that's a little bit confusing, isn't it? We just make up our own history, make it sound like the way we want to. Amazing. Anyway, we know better. Because the Bible says it was David. Saul actually was one of the guys afraid to go into the battle. Oh, well. We saw last week that after David's victory, that the nation became quite fond of David. The women danced and they sang and they made up a new tune. David has slain his 10,000, Saul only 1,000 or so, you know. And I can't remember the way the tune went, but it was the hot thing of the day. I don't know if they were breakdancing or waltzing or doing Havanagila things like this. I don't know. But they were dancing and they were singing. They kind of exaggerated a little bit. They kind of exaggerated David's victories over Saul's. But Saul becomes quite jealous. And even though David's close to him now, has been close to him even before Goliath, he's not so close anymore. In fact, David's become quite jealous of David. Saul has become quite jealous of David. He even tries throwing his javelin at David a couple times. I don't know how he pulled that off, and I don't know how come David still stuck around. I don't know if he said, son, let me do some target practice. Hold the target over here, you know, and then he tries to miss the target. I don't know how he did this. I'm just wondering why David kept going for it, why he was sticking around. Anyway, we pick it up at chapter 18, verse 17. Then Saul said to David, here is my older daughter, Merib. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. Now he says, here's my older daughter. If you recall back in chapter 17, one of the rewards for killing the giant was you get the girl. Remember, you get the girl, you're going to have a lot of money, and your family becomes tax-free. Well, here comes the girl thing. He's got to keep his promise because he told everybody you'd get the girl. And so he decides he's going to hand off his oldest daughter. And he says, only be valiant for me. Because he is thinking, if I send him out to battle enough times, maybe he'll get killed. And then all my troubles will be over. So, verse 18. So David said to Saul, who am I and what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be son-in-law to the king? Boy, it just hit me. It almost sounds, oh my gosh. When we get to 2 Samuel, where's David and Bathsheba? Is that chapter 12, 2 Samuel? When we get to David and Bathsheba, and remember how he tries to get Uriah to go out to battle? And remember how Uriah is so humble? Oh, I couldn't stay. I couldn't go home and be with my wife. And he's got this humility, and it frustrates David's plans of evil. It's interesting. And so David says to Saul, he's got this humility thing going. He says, who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be son-in-law to the king? So even though David's won this great battle, and even though everybody loves him, and he hears his name on the radio all the time, you know, and every time he goes down the street, the girls say, hey, get the tambourine, let's dance a little bit. There he is, there's our kid, you know. He doesn't see himself being worthy to marry a king's daughter. And I just want to kind of chew on something with you a little bit here. I'm calling it humility versus insecurity. I've been thinking about this, and to me it seems like sometimes it's kind of hard to tell the difference between when am I just being humble and when am I flat out just insecure. You know what I'm talking about? Like, I don't think a lot of myself. It seems that a lot of the people that God uses have this strange mixture of humility and insecurity in them. What do I mean? When God asks Moses, you know, the burning bush thing, Exodus chapter 3, and God shows up and says, Moses, go get my people. We need help. Go deliver them. Moses replied, he says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? I'm not, what are you talking about? What are you sending me for? I'm not good enough to do this. When God asks Gideon to deliver the Israelites from the Midianites, remember what he says in Judges chapter 6? So he said to him, oh my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh and I'm the least in my father's house. You got the wrong guy. When Samuel tells Saul that he's going to be the first king, remember how Saul responded in chapter 9? Saul answered and said, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Israel, of Benjamin? Why then do you speak like this to me? Because, I mean, if anybody's going to raise an army, you got to pick the biggest tribe, and you got to pick the guy that's in charge of the biggest tribe. But instead you pick the smallest tribe and the guy who is not in charge of even the smallest tribe. You got the wrong guy. So you see in all of them, you see this thing that you could label it both humility and maybe insecurity. I can see that. I'm not sure I can tell the difference sometimes. But see, gang, the trick is that once God begins to use you, the trick is to stay in humility. I think we actually need to cultivate humility. I think humility is something that you can work at, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. After God worked in Moses, now I know this is Moses that wrote this, but it says that Moses was the most humble man that ever was. I know he wrote that about himself, but I still think it's true. When God used Gideon, after God used Gideon, they wanted to make Gideon flat out king. And it says, And Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor my son rule over you. Yahweh shall rule over you. What are you talking about? You still got the humility thing. And Saul, now God has been using Saul. Well, now Saul wants to kill David. I call that insecurity. You can see that. Can't you see that? Am I off base here in pinning this to Saul? He doesn't like the fact that everybody thinks David is the awesome one. I kind of think it, and I'm only calling it insecurity because I'm so insecure. I really am. I struggle with a lot of stuff. Now, Jesus gave us a pattern at the Last Supper, which, by the way, technically in Easter week, during the Holy Week or whatever people call it, we look at the cross and the crucifixion on Friday, but tonight is the Last Supper. Tonight, in more traditional churches, they call this Maundy Thursday. Now that's not M-O-N-D-A-Y, Monday Thursday, but Maundy Thursday, M-A-U-N-D-Y. And I, for the life of me, can't remember what Maundy meant because I just went off on a rabbit trail and didn't look it up. Anyway, this is the night, theoretically, that if you want to live through this week again, this is the night of the Last Supper. And on the night of the Last Supper, Jesus surprised his disciples by doing something very strange. He laid aside his outer garment, took up a towel, found the wash basin, and started washing their feet. Freaked them out, remember? Totally freaked them out. Peter was like, what are you doing? Oh my gosh. And after the whole episode, it says in John 13:12, now watch this. So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. I mean, you respect me as someone in authority over you. And that's correct, he says. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. Now, Jesus is our master. We're his servants. He sends us. We're not greater than him. He says, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. If our master was a servant, then we ought to be servants. And I'd like to suggest to you, gang, that's how you cultivate humility. Is you serve. You serve others. That's kind of like my dream about Thursday nights. That's why Thursday nights we call the classes the Servant School. Because my goal, I think a mature church looks like a bunch of servants. I don't think you get old enough that you don't, I don't wash windows anymore. No, no. Sorry, I'm too big to, honey, you want me to take out the trash? Are you kidding me? No, no. That's how we cultivate. You're showing me something. I can't read it. Your thing's foot washing. Oh, that's what Maundy means. Okay, there you go. Thanks, bud. He's got this really cool app on his phone where it like shows me texts and stuff like this. He can. I love it. How do you handle it when God begins to use you and God begins to bless you? Because, beloved, when you walk with the Lord, you will taste that, I think. You will taste God using you. You'll be where people will start looking at you and going, wow, I think I want what you got. Not because you're hot stuff. Sorry to say, sad to report. But because Jesus helps us, doesn't he? He matures us. And people want to see what God's doing in our lives. Well, gang, we have to cultivate humility. That's what Jesus did. The King of Kings laid aside his heavenly garments, took on human flesh, became a servant, even to the point of death. And on for him, the night before he dies, he is washing the toe jam out of the disciples' feet. Yeah, good. I'm glad somebody said ooh. That's the idea. Washing feet was only the lowest servant job. That's what Jesus did. We're not above him. We ought to follow him. So, humility versus insecurity. Okay, back to our text, verse 19. But it happened at the time when Merib, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel the Meholathite as a wife. Now, it seems that, you know, David kind of is dragging his feet because he doesn't think he's, like, worthy of her. And I kind of have a feeling that Saul's got this deal with his daughters that, you know, girl, I'll get you. Don't worry, girl. I'll get you married off by the time you're 21. Don't you worry about this, you know. And so she's approaching her 21st birthday or something like this. And David's like dragging his feet and Saul's going, well, what am I going to do? And so he grabs another guy and off she gets married. Okay, verse 20. Now, Michal, you can call her Michael if you want. I'd rather say Michal so she doesn't sound like a guy. And actually, Michal is the actual pronunciation. Now, Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. And they told Saul. And the thing pleased him. I mean, she's like the tomboy that's always out, you know, playing softball and, you know, roughing up the guys and having a, you know, she's a, and he's thinking, well, I could get rid of her, marry her off too. And it says she loved him. And the word means love. That's what it means. Ahav. To love. It's used for human love. It's also used for God's love. But it's a wonderful word. And there's a little bit of a romance that begins to blossom here. You know, she loves the boy, and the boy kind of doesn't seem to be bothered by the fact that this girl likes him. So Saul said, I will give her to him, that she may be a snare to him, and that the hand, she must have been a little spitfire, I tell you, you know, that she's going to be a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, you shall be my son-in-law today. Now, he says that she may be a snare to him. You know, by the way, this is a lousy reason to get married. I just want to let you know, that we're going to get married so we can have a lot of trouble here. You know, that's not a good thing. You know, a young man is in love with two women, and he could not decide which of them to marry. So he goes to his pastor for counseling, and the pastor said, well, describe your two loves. Well, one is a great poet. And the other? Oh, the other, she makes delicious pancakes. I see, the pastor wisely observed. So you can't decide whether to marry for the batter or the verse. I like that one, huh? Okay, that's the only joke I think I got in here tonight. So just enjoy that. You want me to say that again? So batter or worse? Okay, verse 22. And Saul commanded his servants, communicate with David secretly and say, look, the king has delight in you and all his servants love you. Now therefore become the king's son-in-law. So Saul's servant spoke these words in the hearing of David, and David said, does it seem to you a light thing to be a king's son-in-law? Seeing I am a poor and lightly esteemed man. Not only does he have this humility thing, but he also really doesn't have a lot of money. I mean, he is like brother number 8, you know, and so he just is bottom of the totem pole. He's like the bottom tax bracket. And he doesn't have the proper dowry. Now, what's a dowry? A dowry is money that you would pay the dad of the girl, kind of like alimony in advance. It's kind of an assurance that if I'm ever unfaithful to your daughter or I'm mean to her or whatever and she leaves, well, then she gets the dowry. It's kind of like, and she's taken care of and all that. That's the idea. And he says, I can't afford what it would take to be a king's son-in-law. Verse 24. And the servants of Saul told him, saying, in this manner David spoke. Then Saul said, Thus you shall say to David, the king does not desire any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Now, I hope you don't need me to describe to you what a foreskin is. You can look this up in Wikipedia. This is the part of the male anatomy that is trimmed during circumcision. And so the idea that he wants 100 foreskins of the Philistines, Philistines aren't going to give them up very willingly. I mean, that just ain't going to happen. I don't think he's going to go to downtown Gath and say, brother, can you spare a phone? That's just not going to happen. You're not going to get him without killing the Philistines. That's the idea. Am I sufficiently read? Gosh. So when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to become the king's son-in-law. Now, why would it please him well? Because killing Philistines, that he can do. That's something he could do. Now, the days had... the days had not expired. So again, there's again one of these time limit things. And I imagine it's, you know, I promised the girl I'd marry her off by her 21st birthday or whatever, and it's getting close. And so, you know, this, it almost sounds like a used car salesman. And this offer is only good for the next 2 hours, you know, something like this. Therefore, David arose, went, he and his men, and killed 200 men of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins and laid them in full count. I would not like to see that picture. That he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave Michal, his daughter, as a wife. He's not just going to meet the minimum payment. He's not just scraping by. Man, he wants to show off and he wants to do well. It gives double what he was asked to do. It's not just to show that David is serious about marrying Michal, but kind of gives no room for Saul to back out of this as well. Thus Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David. And, I mean, because he was thinking 100 foreskins, surely one of these Philistines is going to say, not over my dead body, and kill David or something like this. But God worked. He saw that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, and Saul was still more afraid of David. So Saul became David's enemy continually. Then the princes of the Philistines went out to war. And so it was, whenever they went out, that David behaved more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name became highly esteemed. So Saul gets worse. He's even more afraid of David. Not only does he see God being with him, and gosh, nobody seems to be able to kill him, but now he sees that his own daughter loves the guy. He's lost his daughter to the guy. And remember from the last chapter, Jonathan, his son, already loves the guy. So like his whole family's like, likes David, and he doesn't like David. And now, with David marrying the daughter of the king, that kind of puts him in the running to become king himself, doesn't it? Insecurity stinks, gang. I'm not sure how all of it works, but it seems to me I'm tempted to do some pretty stupid things because of my own insecurity and my own fears. I mean, most of the stupid things that I do kind of seem to be driven by this. When you're insecure, you lash out at people that you feel are a threat to you for whatever reason. I think the answer to insecurity is confidence. But I don't think the answer is confidence in yourself. I think the answer is confidence in God. Now, I've watched some of the Laker games lately, and Kobe Bryant has confidence in himself. oh my gosh, you know, and we kind of all love it. You know, he makes the winning basket, you know, 3 seconds before the game's over, and afterwards he points at somebody in the audience and goes, because I'm like Mr. Cool. And last night he made like this one basket towards the end that just kind of sealed the whole deal, and he's running back across the court acting like he's an airplane, you know, going like this, and is like, man, this guy's got a lot of confidence in himself. You know what, gang? Our confidence needs to be in God. It's okay if you're not confident in yourself. Your confidence is in God. I think that's the key to answering insecurity. I may be a total jerk. I may not be able to handle this, but God's okay. God's big enough. Look at some of the things that David wrote in the Psalms. Look where his confidence is. I will love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. Who is David counting on? He's counting on God. Remember when he faced Goliath? It wasn't, ha, Goliath, you think you're hot stuff, man, I'll hit you at 50 paces, no problem, right between the eyes, right there, here we go. He does the Babe Ruth thing. He points to the left, to the wall over in right field and says, oh, over there, it's where I'm hitting it out, the next pitch, you know. That kind of a thing. I'm right through your forehead, buddy. No. David says, you come to me with shield and spear and you think you're hot stuff. I come to you in the name of the Lord. Because David's confidence was in God. That's the answer to your insecurity, gang. Is confidence in God. We don't need self-confidence. We need God confidence. Chapter 19. Now Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants, that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. So he pulls all his servants together and says, you know, the little Italian music starts playing, and, you know, and Saul's sitting behind his desk, and he's talking to his mafia bosses, and he's saying, you know, I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse. You know, I find it interesting that at this point, nobody says anything to Saul. Nobody says, are you kidding? You want who dead? What are you talking about? Not at this point. Even Jonathan at this point doesn't speak up. And I'm thinking it's because Jonathan doesn't want to crash his dad's party, because he doesn't want to confront his dad in front of everybody else, is my guess, because he will confront him in a little bit. So Jonathan told David, saying, my father, Saul, seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. Then what I observe, I will tell you. So Jonathan promises, because he loves David, he cares about David, and he promises he's going to intercede. He's going to talk to Saul, and he's going to let him know what his dad says. And thus Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his works have been very good toward you. For he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine. That's, who is the Philistine? Goliath. Goliath. He killed the Philistine. And the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause? In reality, David hasn't done a single thing to deserve this. There's no reason in the world other than Saul's insecurity. And that kind of shows you how rational our insecurities are at times, huh? Sometimes we have it all reasoned out why we shouldn't trust this person. And sometimes it's the head is wrong. Sometimes our head is wrong. So it says verse 6, so Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be killed. Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these things. So Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. So God uses Jonathan, and Saul actually listens to reason for the moment. And for the time being, there is peace. And I love this about Jonathan. He's a great example of a peacemaker. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. I want to show you a video see if you can find the peacemaker in the video.
Say please, sir.
Yes, he did. And thank you.
Yeah, and thank you.
He's a wonderful boy. A delightful boy.
Please, and thank you. Pass it on.
So who was the peacemaker? The guy that handed out the gush. Because he stands between two people, and he makes peace between two people. That's what a peacemaker does. Paul wrote in Romans 12:18, he says, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Now, I like translations like this, because like that, if it is possible, because frankly, it is not always possible to live peaceably with all people. There are some people that you just can't get along with. And so you do your best, but you can't always make peace with everybody, can you? Have you learned that yet? We are learning that as well. But when you can, do your part. Be like a Jonathan. You know, try to speak up for one party or the other to make peace between people. Now, this peace isn't going to last, but I'm glad that Jonathan pursued it. It lasts for a little while. Verse 8. And there was war again. David went out and fought with the Philistine, because that's what David does. He fights with Philistines. That's what he does. That's how he serves his king. He fights with Philistines. And he struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him. Now, the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. That's not a good sign. And David was playing music with his hand. Now, the distressing spirit came upon Saul. David has another victory. And Saul finds himself tormented again. Is there any surprise to this? Is there a connection to this? Absolutely. The two things are connected. Last week we talked about this. We talked about fleshly footholds. We talked about how Saul's anger, his jealousy, I think, is the key to why this troubling thing is happening to him. Whether you're looking at it as a demonic thing or whether it's just a human spirit thing, it doesn't make any difference. It starts with Saul's own anger, his own jealousy, and opens the door for Satan to work. Last week, we saw how when Saul heard that everybody's cheering David and dancing and singing, Saul gets jealous. 1 Samuel 18:10, and it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. In other words, this evil spirit overflows him. So David played music with his hand as at other times, and there was a spear in Saul's hand, and you know, he ends up being target practice again. But it's the same thing. David wins, people love David, and Saul gets jealous, and Saul gets angry. Paul wrote, Ephesians 4:26, be angry, do not sin, do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. Things like anger, jealousy, it installs a handle in your life for the devil to get a hold of. Saul's real trouble is his own sin nature, his own flesh nature. A DEA officer stops at a ranch in Texas, and he talks with an old rancher. He tells the rancher, I need to inspect your ranch for illegally grown drugs. The rancher says, okay, but Don't go in that field over there, as he points out the location. The DEA officer verbally explodes, saying, Mister, I have the authority of the federal government with me. Reaching into his rear pants pocket, he pulls out his badge and displays it for the rancher. See this badge? This badge means I am allowed to go wherever I wish. This badge on any land, no questions asked or answers given. Have I made myself clear? It's the badge. Do you understand? It's the badge. The rancher nods politely, apologizes, and goes about his chores. A short time later, the rancher hears loud screams and sees the DEA officer running for his life. He's being chased by the rancher's prize bull. With every step, the bull's gaining ground on the officer, and it seems like he's going to catch him with his horns. The officer's clearly terrified. The rancher throws down his tools, runs to the fence, and yells at the top of his lungs, "The badge! Show him your badge!" There is no reasoning with an angry bull, right? There's no reasoning with an angry bull. And when we allow anger or jealousy to hang out in our heart, we're that angry bull. We're jumping into the field with the bull is what we're doing. And waving your badge, waving your reasons, doesn't do any good. Doesn't help anything at all. You're heading into trouble. Fleshly footholds. Saul hasn't dealt with his jealousy. Hasn't dealt with it. He's just been talked out of killing David. But he's still got this thing in him. And so there goes David again, doing good. Being a hero again, killing Philistines, saving the Israelites, and Saul's just thrown into a rage. You got to deal with it, gang. We have to deal with these things. Then Saul sought to pin David to the wall with a spear, but he slipped away from Saul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall. So David fled and escaped that night. Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." And remember, this is Saul's daughter that he's married to. And when she's aware of her father's desire to kill David, she tells him he needs to go, and he needs to go now. And it's whose idea for him to leave? Michal's idea. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed, put a cover of goat's hair for his head, and covered it with clothes. That's the old, you know, make them think that you're still in the bed trick, you know, and you sneak out the back window or something like this. So when Saul sent messengers to take David, she says, "Oh, he's sick." You know, she kind of stalls them a little bit and just says, "You see over there, see his head sticking out? Oh, he's just so sick." Then Saul sent the messengers back to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me in the bed that I may kill him." So, see, she sent the messengers back to Dad, and he says, "Don't tell me about it. Just bring him here. I've got to kill this guy." And when the messengers had come in, so they go back to David's house, there was the image in the bed. They all pull back the pillow, and there's Mickey Mouse instead of David, and with a cover of goat's hair for his head. Then Saul said to Michal, says, talking to his daughter, "Why have you deceived me like this and sent my enemy away so that he has escaped?" And Michal answered David, "Oh, he said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'" Is she telling the truth? No, because remember, whose idea was it that she sent him? She sent him away. It was her idea. I kind of have this feeling that she might be a little afraid of her dad herself, and that if she tells her dad the truth, he might kill her as well. I remember the whole thing with Jonathan, when Jonathan, you know, was the hero back in chapter 14 and saved the day, but But Saul was cranky that day and was about to kill Jonathan because, well, that's a whole other story. Verse 18. So David fled and escaped and went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naioth. Now, Gibeah is where they, where Saul is. In Ramah, it's just 2 miles away. It's real close. And I kind of wonder if David has this sense that this is really Samuel's fault. Because Samuel's the guy that poured the oil on him and got him into this trouble in the first place. So he runs to Samuel for help. And so he fled and escaped. Turn in your Bible to Psalm 59. Psalm 59. As we go through 1 and 2 Samuel, we will try to point out some of the instances where we're pretty sure that David wrote some of his songs. I always think it's kind of fun to find out why people wrote songs. I don't know if you do. I know why I wrote some of my songs. I remember some of the instances and the things that were behind it. We have some of the things written in the titles of some of the psalms that give us an indication of where at least somebody thought David was when he wrote the psalm. This psalm, Psalm 59, was written at this occasion, Psalm 59. I'm not going to put it up on here because we're going to read through the whole psalm. And so this is to the chief musician, set to Do Not Destroy. That was one of the tunes. Don't Destroy is one of the name of the tunes. It's a michtam of David when Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him. That's our story. Verse 1, deliver me from my enemies, O my God. Defend me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from the workers of iniquity and save me from bloodthirsty men. For look, they lie in wait for my life. The mighty gather against me, not for my transgressions nor for my sin, O Lord. They run and prepare themselves through no fault of mine. Awake to help me, and behold, you therefore, O Lord God of hosts, the God of Israel, awake to punish the nations. Do not be merciful to any wicked transgressors. Selah, which means stop and think about this. Listen to the guitar a little while. Listen to the drum solo. Listen to the music and think about this. David is crying out for who to help him? He's crying out to God. Remember, that's his confidence. Verse 6, at evening they return. Because you remember the story? They went away. They talked to Saul, and Saul said, what are you coming back to me for? Go get the guy. I want to kill the guy. So at evening they return. They growl like a dog and go all around the city. Indeed, they belch with their mouth. That gives you a little pictures of the guys. Swords are in their lips, for they say, who hears? But you, O Lord, shall laugh at them. You shall have all the nations in derision. I kind of get the feeling that some of the other army men might have been with Saul and thought, yeah, that David gets all the attention. He's the young kid. I've been in the army for 20 years. And look at all the people, you know, praising him, you know. He says, verse 9, I will wait for you, O you, his strength, for God is my defense. My God of mercy shall come to me. God shall let me see my desire on my enemies. Do not slay them, lest my people forget. Scatter them by your power and bring them down, O Lord, our shield. For the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips, let them even be taken in their pride, and for the cursing and lying which they speak. It kind of sounds to me like these guys aren't just out to kill David, but to slander him as well. So perhaps they're going around the city telling stories about David, telling stories, kind of setting the stage for killing David to make it be an okay thing. Verse 13, consume them in wrath, consume them that they may not be, and let them know that God rules in Jacob to the ends of the earth. Selah, think about that. And at evening they return, they growl like a dog, and go all around the city. They wander up and down for food and howl if they are not satisfied. But I will sing of your power. Yes, I will sing aloud of your mercy in the morning. For you have been my defense and refuge in the day of my trouble. To you, O my strength, I will sing praises, for God is my defense, my God of mercy. Now, even though he considers God his defense, he did run away. He was smart enough to know that he needed to leave. You know, sometimes you stand and just let God take care of you. Sometimes God's your defense, but you still need to get out of the trouble, out of the troubled area. Back to our text, chapter 19, verse 19. Now it was told Saul, saying, take note, David is at Naioth in Ramah. Naioth means habitations, and it appears Naioth is in Ramah. Ramah is the name of a city on a hill. Ramah simply means a high place. That's what the name means. And we think that Samuel has established what we could call a school of the prophets at this place, Naioth. You will see this concept of the school of the prophets when you get to Elijah and Elisha, because they had apparently disciples. They were training people to be prophets. You're going to see when we get to verse 20 in a second that there's a group of prophets that are in this area. I think it's possible that what Samuel has been doing is raising up another generation of prophets. One of the Jewish Targums, which is another translation, calls instead of Naioth, it calls it a house of instruction. And so David runs to Samuel at Ramah, at Naioth. When he runs to Samuel, he's running to the Lord. There are a lot of David's songs that talk about trusting in the Lord during times when things are not going so well. You see that in a lot of David's life. A lot of David's life was spent on the run. I don't know if they got the original idea of the fugitive from David's life, but there was no one-armed man. But he was being chased by various people throughout his life. He wrote a lot of things about this kind of stuff. One of my favorite verses is in Psalms 56:3. Old King James reads, "What time I am afraid, I will trust in thee." New King James, "Whenever I am afraid, I will trust in you." David's running to the Lord. Verse 20, then Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the group of prophets prophesying and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. Okay, so Saul sends a couple of guys, a posse, out to arrest David. And as the posse shows up at this place, Naioth, wherever it is, whatever it is, up at Ramah, there's this church service going on. And the guys, they be prophesying. Again, one of the Targums, one of the Jewish translations, translates it into Aramaic, says they were praising God. They're having church. And as these guys walk through the doors of the church, and these prophets are prophesying and praising God, and Samuel's directing the choir or whatever, the Spirit of God comes on these messengers, the officers, the posse. Something happens, and they start prophesying. The word for prophesying is nabah, to prophesy, to be under the influence of the divine spirit. It can also be used to talk about being under the influence of demonic spirits, like we just read in a verse prior about Saul prophesying under his evil spirit. Some have suggested the main idea of prophesying is to speak for, which is in a lot of other words for this, to speak for God. But one of the Hebrew guys says that it comes from a similar word, also pronounced naba, which means to bubble up or to pour out. And the idea is that the Spirit comes on on a prophet and the words just bubble out of him. God pours his spirit in and the words come bubbling out. And so here's the picture. These armed guards show up to arrest David. And the Spirit of God comes upon them. And they just don't have a problem with David anymore. And God's Spirit's overflowing them. What a cool thing. Is that a cool thing or what? I like this personally. I like this one better than the Elijah thing. You know, we get to 2 Kings 1 where they go to try to arrest Elijah. And he says, who are you here for? And we're here to arrest Elijah. And he calls on fire and burns them all. Now, I don't know if I like that one as much. I like this one better. God's Spirit is poured out on these people. Verse 21, and when Saul was told, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. They're getting saved left and right. It's very cool. Then Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they prophesied also. Then he also went to Ramah and came to the great well that is at Seku, which means a watchtower. There's just a place in Ramah. So he asked and said, where are Samuel and David? And someone said, indeed, they are at Naiot in Ramah. So Saul gets to thinking, you know, you can't find good help anymore. And if you want something done, just got to go do it yourself. So off he goes to Ramah. And so, verse 23, so he went there to Naiot in Ramah. Then the Spirit of God was upon him also. And he went on and prophesied until he came to Naiot in Ramah. So before he gets to wherever Samuel and David are, God's Spirit comes on him, and he starts prophesying and keeps going until he reaches David and Samuel. This isn't the first time, remember, that this has happened to Saul. This is not a new thing for Saul. At the very beginning of his career, you could say, Samuel told him he would meet. In fact, it could even be at the same place. It's in the same vicinity, within a couple miles at least. Samuel told him he would go up to a high place where there would be a bunch of prophets, and they would be prophesying, and the Spirit of God would come upon him. And it said in 1 Samuel 10, when they came there to the hill, there was a group of prophets to meet him. Then the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them. This has already happened to Saul. This is not a new thing for Saul. Verse 24. And he also stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? Has he become a Jesus freak? What is this? Is he also among the prophets? It says he stripped off his clothes. Now, it is possible. Now, I know it says naked, but it could be. It may be not completely naked. It's possible that he's just taken off his outer royal robes and he's down to his tie-dye long johns, something like this. It could be something like that, and I would prefer to have that in my mind than the other thing in my mind. Okay, you too? Wouldn't you rather have this picture in your mind? That's Saul, by the way, in his tie-dye underwear. It kind of reminds me of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. Remember he reached this point of extreme pride in his life? Remember that in Daniel chapter 4? And he had this freaky dream, and he told Daniel, and Daniel tells him, but you better watch out because of your pride. He listened to it, but a few months down the road, he just got overwhelmed with how awesome he was, because he was a pretty awesome guy. And God struck him, and he became kind of like an animal. And his hair grew long, his nails grew long, and they put him out to pasture for a couple months. Until his reasoning came back. Daniel chapter 4 says, and at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. God entered into Nebuchadnezzar's situation, humbled him, and he lifted his eyes up to heaven and realized there's somebody bigger than me. And God set him free from eating grass. So I kind of think about that. I think about how God can humble somebody when I think about this thing with Saul. It also reminds me of the last time that Samuel was with Saul when Saul had disobeyed and kind of lost the kingdom. That was like the final straw. It said in 1 Samuel 15, and as Samuel turned to go away, Saul sees the edge of his robe. He sees Samuel's robe, and it tore. So Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you." Kind of makes me think about that, because now Saul's robes are removed. He tore Samuel's robe, and now God's at work, and Saul's robes are off. Makes me think about that. In a way, this is a kind of a judgment on Saul. It says he lay down naked. People are kind of talking about him. God humiliating Saul. And another way, gang, I almost sense a taste of grace here. It's almost as if God is giving Saul another chance to taste of God's Spirit. I mean, how good is that? I mean, is that really that much of a judgment to have God's Spirit poured out on you? That's actually kind of quite nice, isn't it? Isn't it? Is it good to have God's Spirit poured out on you? This is a quiz. All those who think it's a cool thing, raise your hand. Good, good, good. You're with me. Okay. So I see kind of the judgment, but I also see the grace here. And they say, is Saul also among the prophets? That's not the first time that's been said to Saul either. Back in chapter 10. When Saul was filled the first time, the people said to one another, "What is this that has come upon the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" He'd become a Jesus freak again? What is this guy? And I was thinking about this to end with, just end here. God wants us, as men and women, to always be filled with the Spirit. Not just from time to time. Not just, you know, every other year at some revival meeting or I hear something and I yield myself to God. But God wants us to be filled all the time. And yeah, maybe they should say the first time, is Rich among the prophets? Has he become a Jesus freak? That's okay. But you know what? At some point, they should get used to the idea. Not that I revert back to my old life and then I get refilled again and then they're caught off guard. But God wants me to always be filled with the Spirit. When Paul writes in Ephesians 5:18, he says, "Do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation." In other words, it's a waste of your time to get drunk with wine. He says, "But be filled." Don't be filled with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. And you've probably heard this before, but the command in the Greek, it's a present tense imperative, meaning be continually filled with the Spirit. God wants us filled over and over and over continuously. How am I filled with the Spirit? I think sometimes we make it a little bit too hard. And we think we've got to go get prayed for by the right person. And you know, that's an okay thing. That's an okay thing. God works through people to lay hands on and people are filled. But gang, you don't have to go that route. You can just ask. You can just ask God to fill you. It's, I think something that's helped me over the years is the concept of yielding. I ask and I yield. I say, God, I need you. I pray this every day. Every day. Because I leak. I might get filled with the Spirit, but I leak. Something terrible. I haven't figured out how to fix the leaks yet. And I need to be filled over and over and over again. And I ask and I yield. To me, that's a big part. That's a big part of my life, of being filled with the Spirit, is yielding. It's saying, I'm not going to fight you today, God. I want you to work in me as you want to yield to you. Paul writes in Galatians 5:16, he says, I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Now, think about that. That's a pretty cool promise. Would you like that? Would you like to not fulfill the lust of the flesh? Do you know what the lust of the flesh is? It's kind of different for different strokes for different folks. Could be a lot of different things in our lives. The lust of the flesh, the part that's part of our sin nature, where our sin nature wants to lead us. Wouldn't it be really cool to not yield to that every once in a while? Are you awake? Is anybody here in favor of that? Paul says you walk in the Spirit and you won't fulfill the lust of the flesh. What does it mean to walk in the Spirit? I have a brilliant thing I have learned over the years. I want to share this with you. I know this is quite profound. Quite profound. You may want to take notes on this. But I have learned how to walk. Observe. Watch. Step. 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 And what am I doing? I'm walking. Isn't that brilliant? How about that? Your pastor is a smart guy. Isn't that? He's very, very smart. How about that? And I take another step. And I take another step. And Paul says to walk in the Spirit, I'm taking one step after another. I'm faced with choices all through the day. Choices all through the day. Am I going to go God's way? Am I going to go my way? And each time I make a choice, I take a step. And the more steps I take by saying yes to God, I'm a little shaky here, is how I walk in the Spirit. What do you think? Is that brilliant? Isn't that just like, why didn't I ever think of that? You probably already thought of that. That's probably why. You probably already did. But I remember thinking, when that first dawned on me years ago, how simple it is. Nothing magic about it. It's making steps, taking steps, making choices to be filled with the Spirit. Say, God, I need you. I need you here. I got a decision to make. I'm really excited about the messages for this weekend. One of the themes that's kind of woven through the messages is change. And I think sometimes we give up on change. Sometimes we get so used to things being the way they are that we just quit thinking that things could ever change. And you know what? I mean, sure, there are some things that I have to learn to get along with because they're not going to change. And I grow through that. But you know what? There are some things that will change. God wants to change us. Walk in the Spirit. Don't let it be said to you more than once or twice. Oh, is Rich among the, he's one of those Jesus freaks. No, instead they should be saying, oh, that Rich, you know, he's just a Jesus freak. It has been one for a while. I'd rather them say that.